Hi, everyone. Welcome to the CEAI podcast. Our guests today are John Atlas, our Managing Director for Cohen Esri Development Group, and Lee Harris, our President and CEO.
My name is Ryan Huffman. I am Cohen Esri's Chief Operating Officer. So today we get to talk all things development with John. So John, why don't we start the podcast by having you introduce yourself and tell your story about how you came to Cohen Esri.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on the podcast. So I took sort of a roundabout path to end up in real estate. My first job after college was working in Washington, D.C. as a policy advisor to a member of Congress. So I did that for about 5 years. Really interesting job. Got to meet everybody from CEOs of major corporations to small business owners to advocates for a variety of issues ranging from Social Security reform to immigration reform to tax policy. And it was a very interesting position. Got to experience a lot of different parts of the world, but I didn't have a lot to show for what I did every day. I worked really long hours. I might have written a really good speech one day, but at the end of the day, it was a speech. It was over, and I didn't really feel fulfilled by my work. Through that time in DC, though, I did get to spend some time working on economic development projects, and in doing so, got to see the transformation of communities and cities through economic development projects. The one issue was I didn't have any experience doing that, and I didn't have any financial experience, more importantly. So at that point, I decided I needed a little bit more education, went back to graduate school, and decided to get my MBA. Finished my MBA in 2008, which those of us remember was not the best time to be in real estate. I would meet with people about prospective jobs, talk to them about their companies and what they were doing and all the interesting projects. Things were a little slow at the time. I would follow up with them a couple weeks later and find out that they no longer work there. So it was a very challenging time in real estate and the economy as a whole. Through that, though, I did encounter somebody at National Equity Fund, which is a syndicator of housing tax credits. And in doing so, learned about the affordable housing world. So that was really my first position in real estate. Spent a couple of years doing that, ended up moving over to JP Morgan as on the housing tax credit investment side and really learned the business there as well. I got to experience more than 50 closings of housing tax credit developments worth more than $1 billion in a variety of locations, everything from acquisition rehabs of previous apartment buildings to new construction to historic rehab. So in that position, I really started to understand the world of housing tax credit development. But my passion really was for being on the development side, not the finance side. And at that time, I lived in Chicago with my wife. We had two young kids and decided it was time to move to be a little bit closer to family. So I reached out to some people I knew in Kansas City, which is where I grew up. Someone I knew at George K. Baum introduced me to someone at Cohen Esri. And through that, I actually met Lee at AHF Live, the Housing Tax Credit Conference in Chicago in November of 2014. So I was very impressed by him and everything that the company was working on. And through that, we continued our conversation. And the next summer in July of 2015, I joined the team. So that's how I ended up here at Cohen Esri.
Always a fascinating story for sure. And we're glad you're here. So development's been a hot topic of conversation as the housing crisis boiling and investors are obviously seeking those higher returns. Talk a little bit about our approach here at Cohen Esri to development and what is involved in that process.
Sure. Housing development's a very complex process. It involves a lot of different kinds of people with a lot of different skill sets and competencies. And it's really a combination of creativity, finance, and project management to bring a concept to a reality. It really takes a lot of optimism to be a developer. You have to go out and find either an empty lot or a building that might be run down and kind of envision it as something different. And all it takes is money, and you can picture transforming a neighborhood or a community by putting something where there's nothing there right now. Our process has evolved over time, but we do use a lot of data points to analyze markets from both internal and external sources. We look at lots of different factors, not only what the nearby properties charge for rent, but we also look at the amenities that they offer to their residents. We look at the quality of schools in the area. We look at crime statistics. We look at access to transportation. We want to know how close the closest grocery store is. Development's really complicated, very expensive. We want to make sure we're spending our time and our resources on projects that will ultimately be successful.
And that's great information, particularly on the location aspect of what we're doing. And Lee, I want you to take some time. John's talked a lot about housing tax credits and what we call affordable housing in this, which has differences in market rate housing. Why did we choose and have we continued to choose doing affordable housing development primarily?
Well, the big reason is a fact that it has remained for decades and will remain long past our lifetimes, and that is demand. I think there was a Rutgers University study, it may have been a different university, but there was a recent study that indicated that there was as much as a 7 million unit shortfall of affordable housing. And that doesn't disappear overnight. So this was somewhat of a defensive strategy on our part to diversify our revenue base as a company. And so we decided, okay, let's begin developing affordable housing. Sometimes there's a bit of a market rate component mixed with affordability, but for the most part, it's affordable and workforce housing, and we use a variety of products. And the reason we did it is, as opposed to building Class A market rate housing, is in the market rate space, you can get oversupply. You can end up with overbuilding. Generally, that does not happen in the affordable space because of that shortfall, that 7 million unit shortfall. So that's the reason that we went into that direction. The other thing, I like to tell a little story about a project we finished in San Antonio a couple years ago, 200 units. Literally, it's a Class A property. It has a resort-style pool. It has a fitness center. It has the state of Texas' first accessible playground where kids in wheelchairs can actually play on a playground. It's a top-flight property. It costs the same as a Class A property would have cost, and a market rate property would have cost. And we would have had to charge rents probably $2,000 a month or more if it were market rate. Instead, we were able to charge $900 to $1,100 a month because we used affordable housing programs from a financing standpoint. And that's where one of the big differences comes in between market rate housing and affordable development. Market rate, you have debt and you have equity, and that's about it. Sometimes you might be able to wrangle the tax abatement if the community wants that market rate housing badly enough. In the affordable world, we'll layer 8, 10, 12, 13, 14 sources of funding that help subsidize. It's a development subsidy generally, and it brings that. The cost stays the same. I was about to say the cost comes down. It doesn't. The cost stays the same, but you are able to bring all these additional sources of funds in to be able to subsidize the rental rates that you're charging and bring those rents down by as much as 50%. So, yeah, the development process is essentially the same in terms of the bricks and mortar and the land development and all that good stuff, but all these layers of financing are the real critical difference to delivering affordable housing versus market rate housing. And again, the demand factor is a huge deal here that we'll never see this demand factor in our lifetimes ever satisfy.
And Lee, you touched on something that I want to get both of your takes on this because I find it interesting, and that is the perception of affordable housing. So several years ago when I was presenting to a city council, I had a PowerPoint and I put 10 properties, just a photo of the property up on the screen. And it was a mixture of market rate and affordable. And I asked them to tell me which one is this apartment complex. Is it a market rate or affordable? They got every single one of them wrong. And so Lee, you brought up the 200 unit property being a Class A development. And my question to you guys is how do we get around some of the NIMBYism and the misperception of affordable housing being something that is not market rate quality.
Let me address that first. And then, John, you've got a lot of experience with that. One of the flaws in the process in the past has been state housing finance agencies that control the flow of some of these financing sources, believing that we're building the Taj Mahal. That's a political, there was political influence in several states where state legislators were saying, why would you do a Project Albrecht, for example? Why would you put in a swimming pool? I think for the most part, we're past that because it almost sent the signal that the workforce and people that need affordable housing are second-class citizens. And so we fought that perception. That came well before the NIMBYism, I got to tell you. And part of the reason for NIMBYism has been the quality of projects that were built earlier in the late 1990s and the early 2000s that were not Class A product like we build today. And therefore, neighborhoods would see that kind of product and they would rebel against it, frankly. To some extent, it was the type of people that lived there, yes, but that stereotype was perpetuated by poor quality product. And John, I'll toss it to you to tag onto that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to your first point, there's still at least one state that I know of that explicitly prevents an affordable project from including stone countertops, for instance. And stone countertops versus laminate countertops, the cost difference isn't so great, but a stone countertop's going to last a lot longer, but it's kind of perceived as too nice by that particular state, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But in terms of NIMBY opposition, we find that in general, people will tell us that they think housing is too expensive, whether it's for rent or for sale. They know that different kinds of people, whether it's police officers or teachers or the people who work at a grocery store, all need a place to live, and it should be close to the place they work. People want those kinds of amenities near where their neighborhoods are and where they're raising their families, and understand that if there aren't places for people to live, then there won't be people to work in the jobs that are needed nearby. But when it comes down to a particular location, we do occasionally encounter a NIMBY neighbor who doesn't want, like Lee said, those kinds of people here or something like that. Usually it's caged in some kind of discussion about there will be too much traffic or this will make our schools more crowded. But in general, we try to counteract that, like Lee said, by building a Class A project, by building something that is indistinguishable from the place down the street that might charge twice as much. And we're really able to do that through all these different layers of financing. We do have a project in Texarkana, Texas that has 13 different types of financing. And it certainly makes the project a lot more complicated, but it does allow us to really bring the quality up, bring the amenities up, and deliver a project that not only the people who live there can be proud of, but also the rest of the neighborhood.
And those are all good comments, and that presents a good segue. So we've talked a lot about affordable housing development. Let's focus a little bit on market rate development. We have a little bit of a case study, John, for a project that was our first market rate development right here in Kansas City called Midtown Plaza. Why don't you talk a little bit about that opportunity, how it came to us, and really what all was involved with the project?
Sure. So previously, most of our financing relationships and our business expertise were on the development side, were in the affordable space. But because we do have a good reputation, both locally and nationally, we're often contacted by potential partners who bring developments to us, whether they need help with various aspects of it, whether it's putting together financing or providing the kind of back office support to make sure that a project gets built, just because we do have such robust processes in-house and a great track record of delivering on impressive housing developments. So Midtown Plaza came to us through one such party. It was someone we hadn't previously worked with before, but he'd heard of us. He contacted us with, he was the owner of a an 8-story 1970s era office building in Midtown, Kansas City at 34th and Broadway. And it was previously the corporate headquarters of a gas company. And that company had since relocated, leaving the building vacant. So the owner of this building was looking to repurpose it and hired us to help do so. He'd been working on it for quite some time. He had already hired an architect who had done some design work. He had worked with the city a little bit on getting the local approvals that he needed to make that conversion. But he needed help on the financing side as well as the construction and property management side, which is where he came to us. So we ended up converting this 1970s era building to 107 market rate apartments. And the building itself has a great layout for housing. A lot of office spaces aren't really conducive to conversion to housing. If you think about it, an apartment needs to have lots of windows. People want windows in their bedrooms. They want windows in their living rooms. So an office building that's incorrectly shaped isn't a prime candidate for conversion to housing. But this one was a good candidate. One flaw that this particular building had, which a lot of office buildings have, is it didn't have operable windows. So when people live somewhere, they're used to being able to open a window to get some fresh air in. This building didn't have that. So the way we solved that was we actually cut out holes in the side of the building to add sliding doors and little balconies for each unit. So a little complicated factor there, but that really helped make the conversion from office to housing possible.
What lessons did we learn as this was unfolding, both the good lessons and the maybe not so good or challenging lessons?
Sure. Well, good lessons are there are a whole slew of vacant or underutilized buildings in prime locations that are ripe for redevelopment. And it's just a function of finding the right opportunities. These office buildings tend to have lots of parking, which is always helpful for housing. They tend to be located in areas where there's things you can walk to. Maybe they're close to public transportation. They're in desirable areas. There's also a lot of potential resident demand for unique buildings. If you're picturing an apartment building in your head, you're probably going to picture something that's maybe a 3 or 4 story building, and it's got some different facade materials, maybe some brick, maybe some stone, maybe that you can see an exterior staircase. And there's sort of a classic apartment building, but this conversion of an existing building is something that's more unique. It leads to a different kind of floor plan, and it attracts somebody who doesn't want something cookie cutter necessarily. Challenges wise, there's certainly several of them. Converting an existing property is very complicated. You don't exactly know what you're going to get until you start with construction. You don't know what's behind the walls necessarily. Obviously, there's lots of studies that are done ahead of time. We have engineers go through the building and try to do their best work to ensure we can have a sense of what kind of pipes are in the building, what the mechanical system looks like, and what type of potential contamination may be there, whether it's asbestos or lead-based paint. But until you start knocking down some walls, you don't really know what you're going to get. And another thing on reusing a building, there's always a sense that maybe if you keep this particular component, it's possible to save money and you can just reuse it by repairing it and bringing it up to current code instead of replacing it. On Midtown Plaza, the owner wanted to, for instance, reuse some of the elevator components. So they ended up with sort of a hybrid of new and repaired elevator components. And that adds a lot of complexity to the project, knowing what needs to be replaced, what needs to be retained. Same thing on the mechanical systems. So when you are doing a conversion of an existing property, whether it's a historic property or an old office building, you do certainly need to make sure that the project has a sufficient amount of contingency to account for these unknown items, just so that there's going to be budgetary surprises, and you just want to make sure that you accounted for them and can cover those additional costs, because they certainly are going to come up.
And Lee, given those lessons, Is there anything, how does this shape our development model? Is there stuff we would do differently in the future?
Yeah, let's go back to when did we start development? 1994, we launched what's now the Kona Desert Development Group for the purpose of building affordable and workforce housing. First projects came out of the ground in 1996 and early 97. We were developing in small towns. This is something we learned. While there is real demand in small towns for affordable and workforce housing, there is also a rent cap by the marketplace. You can't charge the $1,100 a month that we're able to get in San Antonio. You can't charge that in Goodland, Kansas. People just flat can't afford it. So building smaller rural projects was very difficult. We learned that. And we did a lot of historic renovation in smaller towns as well. We were able to do that without debt. We had a construction loan, but then using federal and state historic tax credits, federal affordable housing tax credits, maybe some grant money here or there, we were able to bring some landmark buildings into fruition as affordable housing. But at the same time, we were able to charge rents that were $400 or $500 a month because we had no debt to service. But that's not a great model in terms of, from a business standpoint, running a development business, building 20 and 30 and 40 unit buildings, and the brain damage to develop historic buildings in particular. And so we evolved. We then did some acquisition and rehab work on some projects that had been HUD financed. They had some Section 8 rental assistance contracts. But at the same time, we looked from an overall business standpoint, okay, how do we scale this? And that's where we ended up doing what we're doing today by building projects in larger markets, larger projects. Those markets tend to be more of the dynamic markets, kind of like we buy the Class B product in Kona Desert Apartment Investors, that business unit. We're following a bit of the same playbook here. And again, the need for workforce housing in larger cities and towns, even. I mean, a 60,000 person town, Mankato, Minnesota, I think that's 100-some-odd thousand people. But we've now built phase one of a project, 48 units there, ground up. We've got a second phase, 64 units in construction. The first phase leased up quickly in about 5 months, 5 to 6 months. And so we're not afraid of the smaller towns, but larger cities, Denver, Colorado Springs, San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth, Jacksonville, Florida, the list goes on and on. They have as much, if not more, of a need for affordable and workforce housing. So from an overall development perspective, we're now working on a scaled basis. We've installed many processes, become much more process-oriented. That is critical. If you're building one or two projects a year, process is important. If you're trying to do 15 or 20 projects a year like we are, that process element is absolutely existential. If you don't have strong, comprehensive, well-refined processes, you'll have failure. And so that's the phase we're in right now, trying to deliver 2,500 to 3,000 units a year in affordable and workforce housing. There's a lot of money involved, and there's a lot of headache involved, and that process overlay is absolutely critical.
And having said all that, Lee, kind of our final topic, but you've touched on it a couple of times. I want to go up to 100,000 feet. Some of our listeners may be contemplating getting in development, and you touched on it earlier and then kind of here, which is this idea of diversification of the business model. So talk a little bit about how adding that development in the 90s and even today, it is a strategy to diversify the business model within the organization.
Yeah, the business model started with property management, apartment management specifically. At one point, we had a commercial component to our company with a large leasing and brokerage operation and commercial property management. We sold that in 2005 to focus on the apartment and multifamily aspects of the real estate industry. So property management is a steady, eddy You live on management fees, and that's all fine and good. We also then decided that we wanted to own. So we've managed over 82,000 units since 1970, and a lot of those lately have been for our own account and our own investors. So there are fees associated with acquiring apartments and operating them through an ownership structure, and the reward at the end when there's appreciation in value. But again, that's a somewhat cyclical business. What we're looking for with the development business is, again, another steady Eddie income stream. We're building up to that and doing it through affordable housing and workforce housing, because the demand is so constant. Even when interest rates are high, like they are, or they're higher right now, we've been in development cycles where the interest rates are higher than they are now, and it was difficult. But because of all this layering of funding, we can still make deals work. That it's hard to do that with an acquisition business when it's strictly market rate. As we know, in Cohen's apartment investors, the last couple of years have been pretty lean on the acquisition side, simply because interest rates don't make these deals work very well. So we've been in a bit of a trough where that phase of the business, the acquisition phase, is concerned. But development should be on the upswing all the time. And even when interest rates go up, okay, we just have to find additional sources of funding. So that's kind of the strategy that we have, is property management, development, acquisitions. Those are the big ones. We have a construction unit. We have capital formation unit, all that good stuff that are ancillary. But that level of diversification, what we're trying to build to is that steady revenue stream that comes from development fees, that comes from property management fees, and then, of course, with the acquisition and disposition of some of those market rate properties that we acquire, that's the icing on the cake.
All this is great topics. Thank you both for participating today, Lee and John, and we will talk to you guys next time.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.